Well, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. And as I said, I'm Mark McClellan. I'm the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. And this is another of our webinars on medical product safety surveillance. Today, we're going to highlight medical product safety surveillance activities conducted by the Department of Veteran Affairs Health Systems. VA has been conducting some important work, and they've been at it for quite a while. The VA's outstanding scientific teams and rich databases make it an excellent environment for evaluating the safety of certain drugs and medical products, and also gives them an opportunity to identify and highlight many of the data and methodologic issues that arise in addressing safety issues, especially in contexts of real-world care delivery with complex patients and less than situations different than traditional optimization or randomization of studies. As you'll hear from today's presenters, VA is also a key partner with the FDA in the Sentinel Initiative as well. The VA surveillance activities that we're going to discuss today include drug safety surveillance studies within the VA population, the evaluation of interventions to reduce risk to patients, the VA's conversion of data to the the Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership's Common Data Model, that's the OMOP Common Data Model, to facilitate participation in distributed queries going forward, as this is, as you all know, an expanding area of work, not only in OMOP's methods work, but in Sentinel and other surveillance activities as well. Today, we're going to have an online web presentation. All of your lines should be automatically muted. If you could confirm that by making sure that your phone or computer is muted, we'd appreciate it. It avoids any background noise during the call. To mute your phone, you can simply press *6. To unmute it, press *7. So *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. And we encourage you to use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen to submit questions at any time during the presentation. These questions will be put into a queue, and we'll call upon you to state your question when we get to that point. At the end of the session, if time permits, we'll open up the lines for those of you who are participating only by phone to ask questions as well. So please do feel free to submit questions at any time, and then we're going to go through them after the webinar presentation. If you have any technical problems, please call the Brookings IT Help Desk, and their number, the Brookings IT Help Desk number, is 202-797-6193. And that brings us to the details of today's presentation. We're very pleased to have with us two individuals from the VA's research team. This includes my friend Fran Cunningham, who's Associate Chief Consultant at the Center for Medication Safety, where she's a program manager for outcomes research at the Department of Veterans Affairs. So, Fran, thanks for joining us today. And also Bernie Good, Professor of Medicine and Pharmacy, a staff physician at the VA Pittsburgh Healthcare System, and co-director of the Center for Medication Safety. So you're going to hear their presentations, and then, again, we'll open up the line for questions and comments, and you can submit those questions and let us know that you have something you want to ask about at any time using that Q&A tab. With that, I think we'll get started. After the presentations, you'll hear Sally Clucci come back on from Brookings to manage the questions and conclude the event today. Fran and Bernie, are you with us? And can you make sure you press *7 to unmute?
Yes, we're with you, Mark.
Great. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting us to present today. What we're going to try to do is cover a lot of material in a short period of time, and we'll be giving you lessons from the VA on our active surveillance activities. And myself, Fran Cunningham, and Dr. Bernie Good will be pinch hitting throughout the presentation, and then at the end we'll be available for questions. So with that in mind, I'm going to go to the next slide, if I can.
Fran, you should be able to advance them yourself, but if you're not able to, let us know.
I'm not able to. I'm trying to now.
There's buttons, I guess, at
Got
the
it.
Bottom, little up and down arrows.
I just did it.
Okay, great.
This next slide just gives you an idea of how we're going to present today. As I said, there's a lot that we're trying to cover because we wanted to give you a taste of some of the things that we're doing in a brief amount of time as possible, but giving it to you in enough detail. So we're going to give you an overview of the VA healthcare system. for those of you that are not familiar with our healthcare system. We'll then go over pharmacovigilance and drug surveillance in the VA healthcare, how our system runs, what our goals are, so to speak. And we're going to spend time describing the databases that are used for surveillance in the VA. I know a lot of people are aware of them, but I'm going to go into a little bit more detail of how we use them. And then we're going to follow up with specifics, our rapid cycle evaluations that we use for drug surveillance, as well as our risk reduction and intervention assessments. And we'll try to give you a couple of examples of some of the projects that we've done in both of those areas. And then we'll follow up towards the end of the presentation, going over our FDA collaboration, and then spending time briefly at the end with our OMOP common data model in VA and how and why we developed it and just where we're going from here, so to speak. Okay. Bernie, I'm going to hand it over to you so you can give the overview of the healthcare system.
Bernie, it's star 7 to unmute or your line.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
I apologize. Okay. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to talk today. I think many of you are probably familiar with the VA healthcare system, but just a few notes about our patient population we serve. There are 23.5 million living veterans. However, only about a third of those get their care currently in VA. We have over 8 million enrollees, and in any one given year, about 5.5 million get health care through the VA, and more than 5 million veterans obtain their prescription drug benefit, some or all, through the VA. The veteran population is predominantly white. We have black, non-Hispanic is about 11%, white, as noted, is 80%, Hispanic 6%, and women are 8%, and as you're aware that traditionally VA has been a largely male population. I will say that this percentage of women is increasing each year, and that reflects the changing demographics of the U.S. military, where more women are serving. Next slide. Whoops, go back one. So the VA, there are 153 VA medical centers, and these medical centers are highly affiliated with medical schools. We're affiliated with 107 medical schools. I think it's fair to say that a significant proportion of medical trainees, including physicians, PharmDs, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, rotate through the VA and get at least some of their training in the VA. We have a large number of outpatient clinics. The number exceeds 1,000 currently. VA patients have very complex medical needs with many comorbidities. They have a lot of disabilities, and we serve a disproportionate number of patients with mental health problems. This has all been seen in a recent paper that we did using the MEPS data, Medical Expenditure Panel Survey data, that's available from AHRQ, which shows that compared to the general U.S. population, we have a significant number of patients with significant mental health problems. If you look at the map of the United States, again, you can see this distribution of where the medical facilities are. The acronym VISNs there, that VISNs basically refer to regions. There are 21 regions, even though you see 22 listed there. There is one number is missing. The acronym stands for Veterans Integrated Service Network, but again, that just refers to a region. So, again, as you see, the VA is spread widely across the United States. Fran?
Okay. What I'm going to cover now and for the rest of the presentation is the pretty much our entire safety program as it relates to active surveillance. And so our center is a pharmacovigilance center, and it's a comprehensive pharmacovigilance center in that we do active surveillance. We also have passive surveillance and communication dissemination and evaluation. What I'll be speaking about today, however, is just the active surveillance portion of it. And inside of our center, we conduct signal generation efforts, and the reason that's italicized is because that's new for us. That's something that we're just in the process of trying to develop. We have a couple of pilot projects that are ongoing. One, we've moved into a full systems project where we're beginning to use it to look at signals and then move forward. So for automated or for signal detection, the signal generation methods that we're using are newer. The signal generation methods that we've used primarily have been anything from the case report to providers in the field identifying and reporting to us things that we should look at, some of our signals that are coming up through our spontaneous reporting system. So that's what we have used in the past. And as I said, the signal generation methods that we're beginning to use now are newer. And that's why that's italicized. What we've been doing for quite a long time is signal strengthening, or now I guess better categorized as signal refinement. And that's where a suspected signal has been identified, and we've taken it to another level where we're beginning to look at is this signal real, and trying to get a handle on what we're actually seeing, so to speak. Inside of our system, we have a couple of things that occur after signal refinement. If we see it and it's a relatively strong signal, since we are a healthcare system, we just can't always sit on it. In many instances, we need to act on it much faster than if we were a regulatory body or whatnot. And so in those instances, we may take the time to move into another project, which is really the fourth bullet point down, called risk reduction or risk mitigation, where we identify patients that are receiving a given drug where we have seen the signal, and we need to monitor the use of that drug in that patient, or we need to roll out specific information to develop guidance so that the drug may not be used in a given patient population until we find more information out. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. So inside of our system, the signal refinement, although it lets us know more about a signal, we have to act on it at times more rapidly than one might think. The third bullet down is signal evaluation or confirmation, and that is divided in our system, because in our system, that's where we roll it over to full pharmacoepidemiologic studies or full observational studies. And there are times when we need to go further with the given exercise, when the refinement is only telling us so much and we need to look at it in more detail using specific methodologies or more complex methodologies, and we do that through signal evaluation and instances confirmation or refuting it. We also have, as I stated earlier, the risk reduction program, and we'll talk about that. That's an intervention program, so to speak. That's when we move in and we act upon certain things. We'll spend a little bit of time specifically describing that. Lastly, we have an intervention assessment, and that's something we started to do. We've been doing with a formulary decision-making process for a while. We've only started to do it from a safety standpoint within the past 2.5 years, and that is that we've made safety decisions to go in and to assess, to assure, to look at the outcomes to see what happened with some of our safety decisions that we made. I apologize, Michelle or Sally. My computer, I'm not able to advance it as rapidly.
For you.
Okay, Goal, thank you. So Goal of VA MedSafe Pharmacovigilance Program, and that's, as I said, we are a comprehensive pharmacovigilance program for the VA system, is to track and evaluate high-risk agents. And the high-risk agents are not just those noted by the Joint Commission or those noted by other governing bodies. These are high-risk agents that we know will be risky for our veteran patient population. If you can remember, Dr. Good stated that our patient population has multiple comorbidities, and so some agents that may not be at risk to the normal population, for some of our sicker patients, they present a higher risk. So we actively or aggressively track some agents that others might not necessarily seem or think need to be tracked as aggressively, and we put them into that high-risk category. We also track high-volume agents, those agents that don't have enough studies on the drug done in a very sick patient population, but will be used in the veteran patient population at a very high volume. So we tend to track those. And we track new molecular entities, and those are newer agents that are coming onto the market, coming into our system with potential risks, either identified through clinical trials or based on the underlying pharmacology of the agent, and knowing the patient population that we serve, we need to track them. Then we look at those as well in the veteran population. We typically determine rates and risks of the adverse events associated with the specific agents. And this last bullet point kind of really hones in on what the emphasis of our drug safety program is. Our major goal years back was to move away from spontaneous reporting, of course, and to use our integrated databases maximally to track drug safety. And so that was the impetus for our center when it initially developed, and it continues to be so. So we utilize integrated databases as a foundation of the VA Comprehensive Pharmacovigilance Program. Now, we also, as I stated earlier, we also have a spontaneous adverse drug event reporting system that's internal to the VA that is web-based and automated, but we typically use that to enhance drug safety efforts and primarily for system-based changes. Lastly, our center is responsible for communicating drug safety information throughout the VA healthcare system, and this often comes in through alerts and bulletins, but it also can be through direct communications with providers, and it also can be by altering our criteria for drug use through a guidance process as well. Next slide, please. So the VA as a resource for active surveillance and adverse event evaluation. Why is it a good source for us to do this? Well, as we stated, we have older, sicker patients, high medication use. Our veterans use a lot of medications. Penetration of new agents is fairly rapid, and I know that's relative for some people, so I do put fairly, in that once a drug comes on the market, even though it may not be on our national formulary, it's still used in our system. Anything that is on the national drug file is available and used in our system. So we have many drugs that are not on formulary that are used as much or and more so than some drugs on the formulary just based on their need. And so the penetration, as I said, is fairly rapid. Small turnover of beneficiaries, yet we share the beneficiaries may use other healthcare systems. So that does become a weakness in our system and something that that we can discuss and that we are aware of. Has very good information systems, and ongoing monitoring of outcomes is in place. Next slide, please. So our VA databases, what do we use? Well, we have prescription databases, and our prescription databases contain every prescription that is dispensed from the VA. So if a prescription is written by a VA provider and filled and dispensed in the VA, then we pick up every and all of those prescriptions. And that's what we use as the basis for our analysis. We have treatment files, and the treatment files come from our electronic health record, where it contains diagnostic information, demographic information, hospitalizations, clinic stops. It contains a great deal of information that we're able to link at the unique patient identifier. We have a vital status file that is our mortality database, so we're able to identify when our patients die. Now, our vital status file is relatively complete, approximately 96%. But it does not give the cause of death in many instances. As a matter of fact, the cause of death can only be identified in less than 10% of the cases. So our mortality file is good for identifying when a patient died, but not the cause of death. So we're still dependent on the national drug file or other modalities to identify a cause of death. We have disease state registries in the VA, and we have quite a few. We have a severe mentally ill registry. We have a diabetes registry. We have a cancer registry. The hepatitis C and HIV registry. There are a myriad of registries that are available in the VA. Not all of them are used for research purposes. All of them, however, are used for patient care purposes. Other databases or other, items that can be used to merge with a database are some of our surveys. And there have been quite a few veteran surveys that have been identified that give us a lot of social information on our veterans that aren't adequately identified in other databases, or you would have to go directly into the electronic health record one by one, or however, whatever method you use to identify certain information. So these surveys provide a wealth of information. The difference is that they are static, and they are often conducted for specific reasons, so you have to get approval to use them. And then lastly, for our projects, we do often use validation methodologies, which we have to make sure that we're identifying the proper outcome. So we will do a random selection and then conduct a central validation. Next slide, please. So the VA databases is a tool. Why are they such an effective tool in the VA? Well, we're able to monitor exposures and rate of adverse drug events, specifically, as I said, with our high-risk agents, with our new agents, and with old agents with newly identified safety information. And this new identified safety information may come from regulatory bodies like the Food and Drug Administration, or it may come from internal usage of an old drug in our system that's being used in a very new population in our system. And so sometimes, again, things that we find important to track from a safety standpoint may not be as important to the public at large, but it may ultimately become so. So when we do that, we do make others aware of what we're doing. VA databases provide the mechanism for active surveillance initiatives, as we're discussing today, but they also provide the mechanism for clinical decisions as well as research. Next slide, please. So how do we do these evaluations? Well, I'm going to spend a brief amount of time talking to you about how we conduct some of our rapid cycle evaluations. We take our databases and we link them at the patient level to monitor agents. And then we follow the patients for a specified period of time, which is decided a priori. We use a control agent, and or we may look at a baseline rate so that we can compare it to the baseline rate, whatever our event of interest is for our given drug. Exposure is assessed, and then rates of suspected adverse outcomes are also assessed. Typically, we use a cohort analysis. We start off with a basic unadjusted analysis. A few years back, we started doing more. We started adjusting for pre-identified covariates, commonly for gender and age. But depending on the drug or the drug class of interest or the outcome of interest, we will adjust for specific comorbidities or adjust for other drugs that the patient may be taking. Within the past year, we've moved to start looking at high-density propensity scoring match methods with our cohort analysis, so we're starting to do more even in our rapid cycle evaluations with a slightly more complex methodology at an early period of time. As I stated earlier, ours is a signal refinement where we spend most of our time, and when we see a given signal, we decide at that point what to do next, stop, move forward for a full study, and sometimes full studies are recommended where more complex methodologies are needed, more or larger validation efforts are needed, and other information is required than that which can be obtained from the database. So we do often move to a full study. Next slide, please. Here's a selected example of surveillance projects that we've done with our pharmacovigilance program over the past few years. Some of them, I've put some of our newer ones on here. We've looked at several things, antipsychotics and mortality. That was one of our earlier projects, and that was over 7 years ago when we were looking at specifically an antipsychotic. It was an atypical antipsychotic that we were supposed to look at, increased rate in mortality. But we wanted to look at all of our atypicals and compare it to typicals because we were wondering why we were only supposed to look at one antipsychotic and mortality. Some of these questions come from the field, some of them come from central office, and some of them we develop ourselves. This happened to be one that came from central office, and we identified in that early evaluation that we were seeing problems with the typical agents as well as the atypicals, and that moved into a much larger study which has since been published. High-dose statins and rhabdomyolysis, high-dose statins and myositis, that's one that we continuously do. Proton pump inhibitors and fractures, opioids and mortality. Prasugrel, which is a newer agent, and one that we continuously look at, primarily for inappropriate use or to make sure they were using it in the proper population, but we specifically look to identify patients that shouldn't be prescribe the agent, specifically some of our elderly patients and those with an immediate history of a stroke. We looked at natalizumab. We looked at TZDs, of course. You guys, that's one that I will present, but you guys may be aware that we looked at heart failure as well as myocardial infarction. Dronedarone, we're looking at the appropriateness of use in that, specifically looking at patients where we should not be using that drug, and those are patients with recent decompensated heart failure, and we'll spend a little bit of time on that. Varenicline and mental health disorders, dabigatran and a myriad of outcomes. This is a very aggressive analysis that we've initiated within the past few months, knowing that the drug was coming on board, and so we're assessing a lot of things in our patients with atrial fibrillation that are being prescribed this agent. Vaccines, primarily the ones that we're looking at now are influenza. We looked at H1N1 as a pilot project, and this year moved it over to a larger project that's newer to us. We just started focusing on vaccines within the past year and a half, with H1N1 being our first pilot project, as we stated, and we will be picking up other vaccines that we will be tracking. And lastly, that I've had identified here is bisphosphonates and O&J. And as I stated, these are just some of the projects we're doing. At any given time, we have at least 15 or more ongoing evaluations that we're responsible for and reporting back to the field. Okay, I'd like to give you a couple of examples. The first one that I'm going to give you is an older one, and that is one where we did a rapid cycle evaluation on rosiglitazone and pioglitazone. And this evaluation was developed and completed relatively quickly. It was conducted secondary, of course, to the publication that occurred in May a few years back. And we have a high percentage of our patients are diabetic. And in that patient population, we wanted to assess, of course, or needed to assess safety. This is one that we were mandated to do. And so we conducted that. We can go to the next slide. Back up one slide, I'm sorry. Okay, perfect. With our rapid cycle evaluation, we identified that, and I'll show you in a second, that rosiglitazone, or shall I say pioglitazone, had lower risk compared to rosiglitazone. And so we made subsequent decisions following that analysis, specifically a formulary decision. We made our formulary decision based on our rapid cycle evaluation and our early study, not our study that had the detailed analysis using more sophisticated analytic methods, but we had to make a decision relatively quickly. And, of course, our detailed study confirmed what we saw in some of our earlier study. Next slide, please. The way that these agents were used in our system, rosiglitazone and pioglitazone, which are anti-diabetic agents, of course, they were used as third-line agents or recommended as third-line agents in our system. So one of the things that we wanted to do when we assessed our evaluation of these agents is we wanted to look at the agents in different lines, first-line agents, second-line agents, third-line agent, and agents when they were combined with insulin. And so we did stratified analyses accordingly. Consistent with VA criteria for use, rosiglitazone and pioglitazone were most commonly prescribed as third-line agents, which is what we were expecting. The health risk for rosiglitazone did not support the high percentage level identified in the meta-analysis. Our relative risk was approximately 1.2. It wasn't the 1.4 that was a 1.4 that was identified in the literature, but it was still higher than that of pioglitazone. So a slight but consistently lower risk was found for pioglitazone compared to rosiglitazone, particularly when rosiglitazone was used as a third-line agent and or when it was used in combination with insulin. Next slide, please. So our decision with the results of those projects, rosiglitazone was removed from the formulary, but it remained available in the VA healthcare system. This is an example of some of the things that we do with some of the results that we get from our internal analyses. Pioglitazone became VA's preferred TZD, or thiazolidinediol, and the criteria for drug use, which we use internally to help guide our providers on how to use specific agents, was updated accordingly. Next slide, please. What I'd like to do now is give you a brief example of something that we do ongoing with some of our newer agents. So this will give you an idea of what we do with the drug as it comes into our system. And the drug that I'm describing now is dronedarone. And what we looked at most recently were patients prescribed dronedarone through second quarter of fiscal year 2011. Everything we do is within fiscal years. And we looked at the number of patients exposed primarily, and then we evaluate for specific outcomes. One of the things that we're interested in looking at is inappropriate prescribing in patients, no matter who the patients are receiving given drug. In this case, it would be inappropriate prescribing in heart failure patients. We wanted to look at exacerbation of heart failure patients. And another thing that we were asked to look at was new onset of heart failure in patients that were newly prescribed this agent or were incident users of this agent. And I had that italicized because that's one that we did collaboratively with our partners through the federal partner collaboration with the Food and Drug Administration and Sentinel Initiative. So we didn't take that new onset heart failure on by ourselves. We did a quick look, but we did a more extensive look in collaboration with our partners, the Sentinel Initiative. What I'd like to show you on this next slide is just a typical way of the way we look things, the way we have to report our information back to the field or back to the providers that are interested. In this instance, it's mostly our cardiologists or our other primary care physicians, our medical advisory panel, and our VISN formulary leaders. So we look at typically, we'll get the total number of all dronedarone users here. We have a given evaluation period, so that may be whatever period that we're reporting on. We identify our cohort, primarily incident users, as you see here, and we identify for this particular drug, we look at those patients with no history of heart failure with the business rules or the definitions that we identify accordingly, those with mild heart failure, and those with recent decompensated heart failure. And then we look over it a series of time, within 30 days, within 90 days, and within 180 days. And I have this last one highlighted because decompensated heart failure is a contraindication for this drug. And if we have the ability to prevent somebody from having an untoward event by identifying those patients that shouldn't be on the drug and warning the provider, then we try to do so. And that's what we call risk reduction or risk mitigation projects. And so this recent decompensated heart failure patient list that we identify or patients that we identify, we roll out as a list to providers to let them know this patient should not be on this drug because of X, Y, and Z, and recommend what drug they should be on. And that's a brief snippet of our risk reduction project. Bernie?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thanks. So I'd like just to give another example of a risk reduction project and talk a little bit about our risk reduction program. So we started the risk reduction program to identify patients who were receiving medications with a true or significant contraindication for a given disease state, or patients who were requiring a change in medication regimen to enhance patient safety, prevent potential untoward outcomes. The other part of this is to do an intervention assessment. We try to do this when we think there may be some relevant outcomes that we want to look at. So an intervention assessment is an evaluation designed to assess the outcome of a specific intervention, that is a safety intervention, a formulary decision, or whatever. So I think that the word to focus on here is outcome. And I dare say I believe we're one of the few healthcare organizations that does this sort of assessment. I think a lot of people will do an assessment just to see, you know, if they were able to get, you know, patients changed or, you know, what's the penetration of the intervention, but they don't go back to say, to look to see whether the desired outcomes actually occurred in the patient population. And one thing we know is that many times things that look good on paper don't always translate into the real world. So we try to think about ways in which we can look to see if our risk reduction interventions actually accomplished what we intended it to do. So what I'd like to describe is a few selected examples, and then I'll give a specific example where we do one such intervention assessment. So We've done a number of these, and here you can see some examples. The prototype was use of nifedipine, that's a dihydropyridine drug used for the treatment of high blood pressure, hypertension, and it's a short-acting drug, which the outcomes for hypertension are not as good as they should be, and it's recommended not to be used for that indication. So that was our first example where we intervened on patients that were receiving short-acting nifedipine for hypertension, and essentially we eradicated it throughout the VA. Another example would be use of high-dose vitamin E. For many years, I think vitamin E was thought to provide health benefits when given routinely for prevention either of cardiovascular illnesses, et cetera. But more recently, it was shown fairly convincingly that this was not a good strategy, and so we developed a risk reduction project to get patients off of this if specifically the indication was for cardiovascular risk reduction. Alpha blockers are used for blood pressure and commonly used also for lower urinary tract symptoms due to an enlarged prostate. More recently, it's been demonstrated that these drugs should not be used by themselves, that is monotherapy, in the treatment of high blood pressure. So this risk reduction project targeted those patients that were only on an alpha blocker and that the indication was for high blood pressure. LABA stands for long-acting beta agonists, and these are inhalers used in the treatment of asthma and emphysema, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And these long-acting products are not thought to be safe when used only by themselves. And so one of our risk reduction projects was to look at that. Simvastatin is a drug used to lower cholesterol, and certainly that's gotten a lot of press very recently. The FDA last week came out with another warning concerning drugs that interact with simvastatin. And one such drug that's been identified a number of years back was ketoconazole, and there's a fairly significant interaction there, so we intervened to try to avoid that in our patient population. Zolpidem is a drug used for sleep disorders, and we were concerned that we had some patients that were on high dose of this where the risks outweigh the benefits, and so that risk reduction project targeted those. And then final is use of glyburide, which is an oral drug used in the treatment of diabetes. And so this risk reduction project looked at use of glyburide in elderly patients with renal insufficiency. That's what RI stands for there. So this is what our goal, a little bit about the risk, glyburide risk reduction. Our goal was to decrease the risk of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar in patients that are at risk. We identified those patients as being elderly patients, that is, over the age of 65, who had renal insufficiency, and that was any patient with a serum creatinine of 2 or greater. And in this risk reduction, we recommended that they either stop the glyburide or switch to an alternative agent. One very closely related drug to glyburide is glipizide. The difference is that glipizide is not renally cleared, and so it can safely be given to these patients. And so, as is the case for a number of our risk reduction projects, this risk reduction project was actually in response to an actual case of where we had an elderly patient with renal insufficiency who had developed a very profound hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. And so based on that report, we looked within our system and found that this was not an unusual situation where we had elderly patients with renal insufficiency. So this is the outcomes, and it's a little bit complicated perhaps to understand, but this is looking over an evaluation period. And so you can see the quarters starting in the first quarter of 2008 when we did our intervention. And the blue line represents all of our patients who were over 65 with a serum creatinine of greater than 2. And we had a targeted group and a non-targeted group. And the targeted group was just a cohort of patients that we identified during a three-month period, and that was identified by patients sending in for medication refills. And so we used that as our target population, but we also followed a non-targeted population. And in essence, what we did was we sent out lists of names of patients to individual medical centers and asked that those facilities intervene. And as you can see, over starting in the first quarter of fiscal year 2008, the number of patients remaining on this this medication who are at risk dropped fairly quickly. There was not the dramatic drop in those non-targeted, but you do see that there was also an effect there in that they slowly drifted down, so that over the next couple years, we were able to get a substantial number of our patients off. I should say that the it was up to the individual treating clinician as to whether or not they thought that they should change their patient off of this drug or not. And so this was not a mandatory, it was just a recommended change that we thought would be useful. But what we thought would be important here was to actually assess this intervention. And so we did a glyburide intervention assessment, and our goal was to assess whether the outcomes that that we hoped to see due to the intervention actually did occur. And we were certainly open to the possibility that perhaps it had some unintended consequences. As you can imagine, sometimes patients get confused when they're told to change drugs. They can sometimes take more than what they're supposed to take, or take two drugs at the same time, et cetera. So we decided that our outcomes would include looking at glycemic or glucose control, look at rates of severe hypoglycemia, and to do a subgroup analysis where we focused on the patients with even more severe renal insufficiency, that is, patients with higher baseline serum creatinines. So looking at glycemic control, this slide's a little bit, I think, misleading, because it looks like after our intervention, glycemic control worsened tremendously. But in fact, the difference between a hemoglobin A1c of 7.17 and 7.22 is all of 0.05, which is clinically insignificant. And the reason why we, when we looked at this a little bit more closely, the reason there was tended to be a little increase in post-intervention glycemic control relate to the fact that some patients, the physician simply discontinued the glyburide rather than switch to another agent, and those some of those patients, their sugars, as expected, did go up. Looking to see if this intervention resulted in a decrease in the rate of severe hypoglycemia. By severe, we meant that this patient either had to be, came to the hospital and was admitted, or at least that this required an emergency room visit for low blood sugar. So this does not measure whether or not patients at home, simply had fewer episodes where the sugar got low, they got jittery and drank orange juice or took something to treat that, et cetera. So these are severe outcomes. And if you look overall, although there was a decrease in the number of events, the P was not significant. So we saw a trend, but we really didn't expect to be powered to see this. I think the important thing is that we didn't see an increase in these adverse events after this intervention. So that was, we thought this was a good outcome. More importantly, though, we looked at patients with more severe renal insufficiency, and those are patients with serum creatinines of greater than 2.9. And as you can see here, the decrease post-intervention was significant. And so, of course, these are patients at greater risk for this adverse outcome. And so post-intervention, we saw a significant decrease in the number of severe hypoglycemic events with a p-value of less than 0.05. So in conclusion, we thought that the risk reduction successfully was able to switch high-risk patients to a safer medication alternative or no medication at all. We did not think that glycemic control was significantly impacted. We thought that that slight increase was clinically irrelevant. And we did, we were happy to see that we didn't have unintended consequences that is more hypoglycemia. And in fact, in those patients with the greatest risk, we saw a significant decrease in the number of events. I'll turn it back over to Fran.
Okay, thanks, Bernie. I'm going to try to wrap things up pretty quickly here. And so what I'm going to finish up with is pretty much our collaboration with outside agencies, giving a brief overview of FDA and then really quickly touching on what we were doing with OMOP. We entered in a memorandum of understanding with the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Defense in fiscal year 2008. And it was primarily entered in so that we could work, I guess, consistently in exchanging information, safety, specifically on drugs, as well as devices. And we also wanted to make sure that there was a bidirectional, collaboration that was occurring so that we could have get things from the different groups as we were embarking on certain safety aspects, and they were as well. So our collaboration consists of a few different areas. We have two of our physicians, Dr. Good and Dr. Glassman, sit on the Drug Safety Oversight Board. We collaborate with the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, primarily with specific studies identified with, by given drugs, and with the Centers for Biologic Evaluation, more recently with the H1N1 vaccine and with the seasonal influenza vaccine this year. And then most importantly, the Sentinel Initiative with our federal partners collaboration, where we've started collaboration with the past few years, and over the past year and a half, and in the past year, consistently develop projects that we can look at in tandem with our federal partners and with guidance from FDA and also input from all of the partners available. Briefly, I'm going to describe, you guys have seen, probably some of you have seen some of the reports and presentations by OMOP, the Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership. What I wanted to do was focus on what we did to develop a common data model inside of VA and why we did it. So I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes on that. Next slide, please. The goal and why we did it is we wanted to identify optimal automated methodologies for signal strengthening or refinement for large number of drugs, and also to be able to participate when certain questions were asked to be able to evaluate the drug similarly to other organizations. So by developing the common data model, we will be able to do such. So the next slide, please. So we converted our data to the common data model. We took our VA data, identified and extracted and cleaned the data. Data were mapped using mapping tables. I've identified how we did that, listed beneath. We used various SAS programs written to convert the data to the common data model. And then upon completion of the common data model, we developed tables, drug and condition era tables were created under the guidance of OMOP. And we had health outcomes of interest and drugs of interest tables were developed for us to assess. Next slide. This is a slide that just defines the mean area under the curve, for each method. So with our AUC, we looked at 11 of our successful methods, but we were only able to run 11 of the 13 methods. And we ran them for broad categories, which were identified by the original 213 test cases, categories with no labs, and those are only test cases that were derived for health outcomes of interest, and we used definitions that did not require lab values. And the broad category, we use all drug outcome pairs that involve the first diagnosis code or the first definition that was defined by OMOP. And this is something that you can look at on your own, but I just want to show you which methods we used and what some of the results showed. Next slide, please. This slide just shows an output of our relative risk for an individual drug of interest and the health outcome of interest, specifically ACE inhibitor and aplastic anemia. And I specifically chose this one to show because it identifies where some of our methods, this is a negative control, work when they probably shouldn't have. So it kind of shows you where we are. This is a fantastic project that we're in the midst of working on. And this year we're kind of spending time going through what we need to do to understand why certain methods work, why certain methods didn't work, and whatnot with the different outcomes of interest. Next slide, please. Limitations so far that we've identified as performance depends on parameterization. Patterns of utilization also influence outcomes that wasn't accounted for that we need to assess and determine what we need to do with some of the methodologies. We need to understand why some of the successes of the methods occur, which we don't understand in some instances, and that's what we're spending time doing this year. Next slide, please. So we want to assess models, and we're going to do reparameterization. We're going to identify best methods for specific outcomes. We're going to compare with prior evaluations that we've already run for full studies that we know should work, along with several other items, and that's what we're doing over this next year. So to wrap it up, what do we do and what have we learned from our active surveillance activities? From rapid cycle evaluations, our results provide information predominantly for risk reduction efforts, formulary decisions, and that includes developing criteria for drug use further developing or changing some of our criteria for drug use, or it determines when further studies need to be conducted. Our risk reduction and mitigation we conduct primarily to enhance patient safety via prevention of potential adverse events. That's the biggest thing. We want to intervene when we can. And lastly, we'd like to intervene and assess our interventions. So with our intervention assessment to help determine impact of our decisions and interventions, we've been conducting these. And I said within the past 2.5 years, we've started to do more of that with our safety decisions alone. And that's it. And we're open for questions.
Thanks a lot, Fran and Bernie, for your presentations. It's very clear that that there's a number of ways in which a lot of the work that you're doing can be very informative to others. And to that end, I'd just like to ask, before we go into questions, I'd like to ask Judy Rakusin, who's the scientific lead for FDA Sentinel Initiative, to spend a few minutes discussing what Sentinel thinks it might be able to learn from all of these great activities that the VA is doing. So, Judy, if you can take a minute and press *7 to unmute.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, thanks for reminding which button to push. So first of all, thank you, Fran and Bernie, for talking today about the VA experience in this active surveillance area. I have to say that when I took over as the Sentinel Initiative scientific lead about 2.5 years ago, Fran was one of the first people I called. Because I knew that the VA and her group was working on rapid cycle analysis and developing methods for active surveillance, and really it was the VA experience and the experience of the Vaccine Safety Data Link at CDC that has substantially informed what we have done in these early years of the Sentinel Initiative. So. Learning about the methods and approaches that are being used for active surveillance of new medical products, and then having VA now participating along with CMS and DOD in the Federal Partners Collaboration allows us to work closely with our federal partners and to have them help us develop the methods that are necessary to do this kind of active surveillance with drugs and other medical products. I think the work that the VA is doing in the area of risk reduction and understanding the impact of their interventions are very important for us as well, because various evaluations are conducted within Mini Sentinel and the Federal Partners Collaboration, and eventually that information is considered along with everything else that we know about a given safety issue, and eventually with FDA taking regulatory actions, it's important for us to be able to measure the impact of those regulatory actions, and so we can learn from what the VA and others are doing in this area of measuring the impact of interventions. And I think I'll stop there.
Thanks a lot, Judy. We have a couple of questions that have come in. So what I'm going to do is just turn it over to the people that actually asked the question to go ahead and unmute their lines and present their question. So the first one is from Wanju Dai. I think that I've pronounced that correctly. So, Wanju, if you want to just hit *7 to unmute yourself and ask your questions, please go ahead.
Yes, my question is whether people working in pharmaceutical companies can work with VA experts using the VA data to do active surveillance, and if yes, how?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, thank
you. Okay, this is Fran. To do some of our rapid cycle projects, no, we have not worked with industry from that standpoint. That was always something that was conducted internally. To conduct full pharmacoepidemiologic studies, absolutely. There are quite a few of our investigators that work along with industry, and so there is and always has been the availability for industry to collaborate with VA investigators. But the VA investigators, VA data remains inside VA, and so the VA investigator would be the primary investigator, the principal investigator conducting the study.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then our next question, I sort of cringe to allow it to be asked because I know that there's no easy answer. But Penny Cleveland Scott, do you want to go ahead with your question? And again, it's star 7. Okay. Well, so Penny's question, and I'm not sure whether it can be answered easily or not, Fran, but it's what is your definition of a signal?
Oh, God.
And I know that's something that we've gone round and round on here.
Okay. Well, if we're using a specific signal detection method, it would be something that reaches or extends the critical value. So we will identify specific critical value and when our, risk exceeds that critical value, then that's a signal. That's probably the easiest answer, but not the best answer, because we get a lot of other things that we call signals. And so, like you said, it's no easy answer, and we could sit and talk about, since we're looking at right now, three different signal detection methods, and we're using, you know, slightly different methods to identify signals in all of those. So, like I said, with the specific signal detection method, we look at a signal exceeding the critical value, and that's what we will call a given signal. Otherwise, and I hate to say this, we will look at a trend of reports that come in from the field with some of our newer drugs that are released or using a given patient population. A couple of those have proven to be true signals. So, sorry, don't think that's a great answer, but the best that I can come up with in a short period of time.
Well, thanks, Fran. I do appreciate you giving it your best effort. So we actually don't have any other questions in the queue right now. So what I'd like to do is to make sure that if there's anybody participating by phone rather than webinar and has questions that they'd like to ask, to go ahead and unmute their lines by pressing star 7 and then ask their question. So I'll just give a few seconds to see if anyone chimes in.
Send you the Skype, and you can have a slide.
You can
send it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like anyone has any questions. It sounds like we got a little bit of background noise here. I'd like to take a minute and just thank Fran and Bernie for their terrific presentations today and for all of the work that they did to prepare. And I'd also like to thank everybody who tuned in for today's webinar.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting us.
It's our pleasure. We are hoping to have our next webinar in July. We're still working on confirming a date and a subject, but we'll be sending out an announcement about that in the near future. And then lastly, presentation materials from today's webinar will be posted on our website, but probably not until early next week. So, thanks once again to everybody for participating, and we'll look forward to tuning in or speaking with you all again soon. Thanks.
Thanks so much.